Good morning, everyone. Our 14th meeting of the 87th session will come to order, please. Representative Peterson, Sandra, would you look over the minutes before I have you move them? And everyone, you know, we should always look over the minutes because we're not infallible, and sometimes there are mistakes. If they're technical, call our attention to them, too, if we have misspellings, because we want them to be accurate.
They look fine to me, Madam Chair.
Representative Peterson, Sandra moves the minutes. Are there any additions or corrections? Hearing none, seeing none. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, same sign. The minutes are adopted. And we move on to House File 511, and Representative Depke will take the chair.
Thank you, Representative Erickson, and we do not have a quorum. We do have a quorum.
Yes, we do.
Oh, we do. Wonderful. Okay. Sorry about that. So, Representative Erickson, if you would like to continue with your bill where
Thank
we
you,
left
Madam
off.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move the amendment, the A3 amendment, the H0511A3 amendment, to put the bill in the order for us to discuss it further.
Please proceed.
Would you like to vote on it so I can get it?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Attached.
Representative Erickson moves that the A3 amendment to pass. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Thank you very much. The amendment passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and everyone. If you want to focus on the amendment, we have. Change the language for the opportunity for school boards to use interactive television technology for their meetings. It seemed as we reviewed the section that was present in the original bill that we could do a better job of referencing a different section. This time it's 13D.02. On page 2, line 29, because I did not know when I drafted this that the department had already begun working on the social studies standards revision, so that date has been reinstated because they are in the process. But the date for implementation will be changed to 2014-2015 to give school districts a chance to hopefully have enough money in their budgets to either purchase textbooks or the kinds of materials that are often used for social studies, our handouts, so that we have the most up-to-date information. Or I'm thinking that there might be the use of iPads or e-books. So we want to give them some time. That's the reason for that change. And then because review occurs on a cycle, changing that last date for the next review of the standards and the benchmarks for social studies to 2020-21. And as I mentioned earlier, because of the change in the language on the use of technology for board meetings, we'll delete section 2 on page 3, and then everything is renumbered accordingly. So, Madam Chair, that's the amendment. And I believe that what we were starting on as the bell rang to end class last Thursday was section 3 on page 3, the fact that this 403, B plan was something that was inserted in the pension bill and never discussed in education policy. This is an opportunity, members, for school boards to offer to their employees a kind of 401k, except in the education arena, it's called a 403b. And it turns out that the vendor was limited in this particular legislation of last year. And school districts, school boards have asked in this mandate relief that they be able to determine the identity of the vendors. And we want to, at least I want to, give them that flexibility. And maybe there will be questions later. And then Representative Depke, well, maybe first of all I better cover the community education director. I imagine there will be some discussion later about the number that we inserted. This would be a board of a district with a total population of 10,000 or less could identify an employee who holds a valid Minnesota principal or superintendent license to be their community ed director. There might be questions about that later. Section 5, the rulemaking, it's possible that when this moves to K-12, and Madam Chair, I do want to remind you and members that this, my motion will be as it was last Thursday to pass this to the Committee on Government Operations. But perhaps there will be some revision of Section 5 in that in visiting with our researcher, Lisa Larson, we might have a redundancy here, and we may want to look further at the language and make a reference to a rule, perhaps, instead of just repeating ourselves here, even though I think the language is explicit. Then we move to the schools, Safe Schools Levy, and Representative Depke, would you like to explain that to the members?
Yes, I will. And we can, I'll just give a brief summary over of the bill, and then obviously there might be questions later. Essentially, this particular bill, House File, is also House File 88, and essentially it is removing the maintenance of effort and set aside requirements for school personnel and returning the financial decision making to the school districts. The school districts are required to set aside at least $3 per pupil of its safe school levy for $30 for certain support personnel. This language repeals the maintenance of effort requirement. The safe school levy amount remains at $30 per pupil unit, but allows the school district flexibility to decide where the $3 is spent and within the eligible expenses of the safe school levy. Thank you, Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Representative Depke. And I'm sure there will be questions and testimony later. Section 7, removing the temporarily suspending the 2% set aside for staff development. And Section 8, the fund transfers. And I believe Greg Crow is available if we have questions in regard to that. And finally, the January 15th repeal is Section 9. And I misspoke, actually, when I was talking about the special education rulemaking, Section 5. In referencing Ms. Larson's note to me, we could probably further clarify the good cause exemption under Minnesota Statute Section 14.3888 as it applies to those cases where federal and state could conform. But I guess we want to be very thoughtful about making sure that there's specific legislative authority when changes are made in our special education laws and subsequent rules, because that is such a complicated area with both state and federal law. So, Madam Chair, I'm ready for questions and or for testifiers.
Representative Greiling, I believe you were last on the list on Thursday, and if you would like to start out the questioning, that'd be fine.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of my questions is mostly addressed because it was the social studies, why the four-year delay, and now I'll just ask why the one-year delay. Why are we? It seemed to me when we heard from Ms. Ani last week that things were well considered, well underway at the current pace, and there's a lot of things in there that, including the financial knowledge for students that we've been pushing for in the legislature for quite a while, and I'm wondering why you want to delay it even 1 year with your amendment, which is much better.
Thank you, Representative Greiling and Representative Depke and members. It is a request brought by school districts to delay implementation so that they might have the funding available for whatever avenue they pursue, whether it's new textbooks, whether it's iPads, e-books. Considering that we're in the era of technology, there might be some different avenues that school districts want to pursue. So we'll just hold that out 1 year. Hopefully they'll have more revenue by that time. And to answer your question, Representative Greiling, and I'm glad you brought it up about economics, I did have Representative Kurt Bills, who teaches economics, look through the present standards and explain to me whether or not our present standards are delivering to our teachers and then to our students what I think we're hearing a plea for, and that's more ability for our students to understand finance. So Representative Bills walked through the standards and the benchmarks for me, particularly the benchmarks, and pointed out to me everyone that deals with finance and members, there are a multitude of them. So if this is followed through in the classroom, our students should be receiving adequate information and should be checked on what they understand about personal finance. Furthermore, Representative Bills noted that we don't want in economics just to focus on personal finance, that if we're going to call it economics, it's far greater than just personal finance. But I know that's what I hear from parents, and I've gotten a few emails in recent days with the introduction of this bill's appearance saying, make sure my child understands personal finance. Representative Bills says it's in there, and so I hope it'll even be better as the new standards are, and the new benchmarks in particular, are reviewed and finally adopted.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Erickson, I agree with Representative Bills. I've always thought it should be broader, and I'm glad to hear he does too. If it's going to be a matter of finance and there isn't enough money and the districts then want to delay it, then I would be willing to consider that at that time. But right now, when we have Governor Dayton's budget, which actually adds money to education, to me the only reason to plan ahead to delay this would be if we're anticipating a cut to education. And the rumors do abound that that is what the majority caucuses are going to propose. I've heard a 2% cut in the budget, and who knows where it will come from. But Representative Erickson, if you are planning for that, then I could see where this bill would be in order. But it seems to me it's kind of putting the cart before the horse. If we, battling a sore throat here for the last few days. Don't know that yet, I would urge us not to. Of course, we have policy after finance, so we can look at this at that time. But I'm concerned that school districts already are anticipating being short of money. That's a statement, Madam Chair. And then I have a couple of other comments, and then I'll end with a couple of questions. Representative Erickson, you might be surprised to know that I actually agree with you on the rulemaking for special education. That was a committee in my obscure past that I chaired at one time here in the legislature, and I wanted to get rid of generic rulemaking in general for the agencies. I think they always should have to come to the legislature if they're going to do substantive rules. If they're just updating and doing things for good cause or conforming with the federal government, that's one thing. But when they actually have new ideas, those, in my opinion, and I think if we sat and thought about it, it would be a lot more legislators' opinions than just Representative Erickson's and Representative Greiling's, that rulemaking is to complement and supplement state statutes, and it shouldn't be making law and coming up with new things. So I agree with you on that, and if you ever want to get rid of generic rulemaking ability for agencies, I would join you in that effort.
Madam Chair. Madam Chair?
Yes, sorry.
Representative Greiley, do you recall in 2006 whether or not we intended, and I'm referring now to Section 1, to make rulemaking just a given for the department in regard to the standards? Do you recall that? Because I understand that our intent was not to give them just general rulemaking authority when it came to the standards, which is why I have that language in Section 1. But do you recall? Because we worked on this together.
Yeah. Madam Chair.
Representative Greiley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Erickson, I don't recall. I have a poor memory. For if I always am in terror, I'm going to get on a witness stand, and they're going to say, with your hand on the Bible, what day did this happen, and what did you say then? And I will be in big trouble. But I just generally have the philosophy that that we should be the instigators of rulemaking and give direction. You know, sometimes we're guilty of throwing them, do this, do that, and we don't give them any direction because we're afraid of issues ourselves or we can't agree, and that's passing the buck and so forth. So I don't remember, but whatever it was at the time, I hope I agreed with you and was consistent, because this has been a consistent opinion of mine for quite a while. There's a lot of things in your bill that I'm not going to comment on because they're things I don't like, but they're things we have been doing lately, like the staff development and so forth. Just because of finances, and both parties have done that. The community ed director, I'm perplexed why we need that when we already have a waiver in law. And to me, we should, current law is stronger because it takes the position that, of course, we're going to have community ed in every school. We want equity around the state for all of our students. And but if there's a hardship, they can get a waiver. But to just plain let them off the hook creates inequities, I think, in the small communities around our state. Because the community ed, what community ed does is, I think, you know, research bears it out and public opinion bears it out that it's very, very important what they do. I'm going to focus on Section 3, and this is my last comment, Madam Chair. And that is, yes, this section was put into the pension bill a couple of years ago, and I supported it actually going into the pension bill, and I strongly object to it coming out. We had, and I think it might have been when you weren't here, Representative Erickson, but we did have a situation in Osseo where, you know, we have this idea that employees should take more control of their health plans, their retirement plans. And I think that that's right. You know, if you're going to be cost effective, and then you need to have more people than just the pension plans or the health uppity ups paying attention to cost. But your this section goes in the opposite direction because the school district of Osseo got down to having just one vendor, and then we expect school employees to have their you know, make choices or be smart about their retirement plans and help out with things that are being done on their behalf. And if we don't have this provision in law, we could open ourselves up to being back to where we were before, where we might want to bash public employees till the cows come home. But if we don't, if we want them to be responsible, we have to give them some choices. And I don't know, I think, I wonder if there's anyone here that's here in the audience that would know any more about this issue than I do, but I know that often when we cover issues, there's experts here that could testify. Is there anyone here, like a third-party administrator? Nobody.
Is okay. The author of the bill, are you all right with that?
Oh, yes, Madam Chair and Representative Greiling. Every one of these mandate relief provisions came from school boards. And I happen to have faith in school boards that as the employers in the school district, they should be able to determine the vendors that they want to use for a 403B. Now, that, you know, probably it is questioned by some. But they are the employer, and we do elect them to be the employer, and sometimes we forget that they really are in charge in a school district. And I want them to be honored as that, You know, and if we don't like them, we get rid of them in elections. But they are elected to lead. So I would hope that they would be able to make those decisions. But I'm sure if there's someone in the audience who would like to speak to this, that we'd like to learn more.
Is there anyone in the audience that would like to speak on this particular issue?
I am a third-party administrator in the school district.
Would you like to come down to the podium, please? And would you please introduce yourself and state your name clearly and the group that you are associated with, please?
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Paige McNeil, and I work for a company called Educators Benefit Consultants. And we do 403B compliance, administration, and compliance for probably 230 school districts here in the state of Minnesota. We also run some other benefits, but that seems to be the biggest part of our business today.
Thank you, Ms. McNeil. Would you like to testify?
Sure. I'll make a few comments, and if anyone has any questions, I'm happy to answer them. A couple years ago, the federal government implemented some 403B rules and shifted some administrative responsibility to school districts. There was a little misconception about what the rules did at the beginning, but after some follow-up communications with the school districts we work with, we sorted it out. What the new rules actually did was shift the responsibility of administering plans to the employers. IRS was worried that some revenue wasn't being tracked properly. People were over-contributing, hardship loans were being taken out without stopping contributions, and they had concerns that they were missing out on some tax revenue. This shift in administrative responsibility, however, did not shift them as to having a fiduciary liability. So technically, school districts did not have responsibility to pick investments, worry about how investments were doing, and the fees associated with them. Now, some school districts read the rules a little wrong, misinterpret them, and some just felt a paternal or maternal desire to pick some investments. That process is pretty costly, and I believe that this legislation would shift the responsibility ultimately to the school districts. They may feel that by this legislation they do indeed have the responsibility to pick investments, and they can pay a lot of money to have that process done through consulting firms. Right now, the last year, I see in the school districts I work in, and I have the majority of them here in Minnesota, the process is working really well. The union folks are working with the administrators. They've set up their own rules as to how many investment companies will be in. They'll set standards like a new investment provider has to get 20 new clients before that company can be added to the list. And they'll also work out things together. Shifting the responsibility only to the school boards, I believe, is going to make them feel like they need to spend the money to do this right, and by federal law, they don't need to. So I'm just a little concerned that it's going to cause some upheaval, because this money is, frankly, 95% employee contributions, not employer. It's their money, the teacher's money. Excuse me, I'm a little nervous. And so I'm just a little concerned that we'll have this shift and everyone will, there'll just be a lot of discontent again, and right now everything's working smoothly. They work together. And because of the rules, we had investment companies just go away, frankly. They're not in the business anymore. So school districts don't have 35 or 40 vendors anymore. That's just the reality of it.
Thank you, Ms. McNeil.
You're welcome.
Yes, Representative Greiling.
So thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. McNeil. I have always I like to find benefit plans for retirement and for other things, but I always know that a lot of people flirt with defined contribution and mm-hmm. and that's often put forward as a way to save money and at the expense of people who invest poorly, and then those would be the workers. But if we're going to have this be all employee money, then it seems the least we can do is let the employees have the say-so mm-hmm. in how they're investing it. So I guess I didn't catch where you mm-hmm. were from exactly, but can you comment on this on the national scene? And you said there's a federal law already mm-hmm. that covers this, and what do other states do?
Ms. McNeil.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you. Yes, there is a federal law. It took place enacted in 2009. And so, like I said, the responsibility of tracking 403B transactions is the employer's. But again, the investments, how they perform is not. And here in Minnesota, there is a lot of involvement from the school districts. There always have been, even before the rules, because in Minnesota we have a match program. So there's a lot of matching going on here in the state of Minnesota, unlike some other school districts. But still, we have to remember, these are individual supplemental retirement accounts. They still have access to TRA, Teachers Retirement, PERA. So this is indeed mostly voluntary employee money. And personally, with the schools I work with, and I do work with most of them, I don't see a lot of fighting amongst the administrators and the union teachers about the investments provided. They've all worked together really, really well. The only school districts who did RFPs, requests for proposals for investment companies, there were about 45 of them. Those were school districts who had larger ones with consultants who said, you know, this would be a good chance for you to look at what's in the district and find nice investments for your teachers. But a lot of times during that RFP process, we saw the teachers, the union members, get upset because their choices, their favorites, were taken out. For instance, American funds, good example. A lot of American funds in the school districts. With the RFP process, the RFP request didn't get to the right people at American Funds to submit a proposal, wasn't submitted, they were ousted out because they didn't have a proposal and they were a favorite. So we do have just a couple school districts that have added back some investments that they lost. And I just think that the system isn't broke, frankly, and I think we should leave it alone for a little while. It's working good.
Thank you, Ms. McNeil. Yes, Representative Greiling, we'll do one more question if you don't mind, and then we have a couple of other people that want to.
Definitely the last question.
Thank you.
But I would urge Representative Erickson to consider taking this out. I already don't support the bill just because of the maintenance of effort of the school support staff alone, and there's other things in here. But this one I would urge you to look at and rediscuss with the boards of education or whoever wanted this. Because I think there were very good reasons why we had the change that we had while you were not in office.
Ms. McNeil, I do have one question for you before you leave the podium. Clarify again the organization that you're with. I want to make sure that we have that. And then also tell me how many school districts are part of your group.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, my name is Paige McNeil, and the company is called Educators Benefit Consultants. We specialize in only working with school districts, public sector plans. We work in Minnesota, Wisconsin, Iowa, North Dakota. Minnesota is our prominent place of business, and we have 237 school districts that we work with. And, you know, I'm never quite clear about how many districts there are in the state of Minnesota. I know it's over 300. So we have a good majority, between 300 and 350, I think.
Thank you, Ms. McNeil.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Right.
Committee.
Appreciate it.
And Madam Chair and members, again, if you read the rest of this section, the school district is definitely involved, but since the school board is the employer, I would still agree that they should determine the vendors, the number of vendors they want. That's, I think, just a normal procedure when you have an employer. You know, we're all paid if we're in the arena of teaching and education by the taxpayers, and so I think this gives those who are elected by the taxpayers that ability to determine something that's very important. And absolutely, I think it's great that teachers are and other school employees are interested in 403B plans. That's essential in this day and age.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. I do believe we have one more question on this particular section of the bill, and it's from Representative Driscoll.
Madam Chair, thank you. Representative Greiling, I have a little bit of experience in the industry, and I'd like to maybe just help you and others understand a little bit about some of the dangers of having too many vendors available for choice. In these types of situations, the vendors are typically called families of funds or mutual funds. So you'll sign a contract with the product provider, who, if the provider is doing a good job, will have a diversified number of funds that are in there. You may have some say, for example, S&P equity funds or some growth funds or some stable return funds. And limiting the number of choices is actually can be very good for the employee, because what tends to happen sometimes, if employees have too many choices, they may actually invest in the same fund across different vendors and lack diversification of their investments. And that can be a boom or bust depending upon how that particular fund or market or sector is doing. The other downside that you have is that if you have too many choices, you don't get what are called price points or break points in purchasing these types of different products. Many of these are called load funds, which means that the employee pays a certain fee and then part of that goes to an agent or a security representative who helps the individual with their investment mix. If you invest outside of that family of funds, what ends up happening is you don't get to those breakpoints. You start two different or three different breakpoints within a family of funds, which means that that individual could have more of their investment go toward fees for the sales representative versus being invested on their own behalf. So there is some merit to considering limiting the number of vendor choices that are available within the industry. So I just wanted to bring that forward as some background of 9 years as a training manager within a large broker dealer here in the state of Minnesota.
Thank you, Representative Driscoll. Representative Erickson, pardon me. Would you like to continue with the bill, or would you like to have some testimony?
We may have others who want to testify to various sections. We may have others who have questions.
Okay.
We have this entire committee meeting to devote to this. So,
all right, we will continue.
Let's
then
vet it thoroughly.
Good. Then we will continue with questions from the committee. Thank you very much, Representative Kath, to this particular section of the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think members, I want to rise to some of the questioning on this section as well about the 403B. And I think what's important here is how school districts have already been implementing this. As a teacher and somebody who has a 403B through my local school district, I watched this transition. And really what it did, it has allowed us as teachers to work with our school board as a condition of employment to say what vendors should be brought forward, how as a bargaining unit along with the school board do you want to push some of these vendors. And we actually brought all of these vendors in that our district was using and really looked at them, plus brought in other vendors in to say, what are your rate of returns and how are you working here? And specifically, it educated our teachers, those people that were on 403Bs, as the contributor of 95% of the funds. You know, that was 95% of my money going into that. It educated me on what are these different vendors and how are they performing, and we worked with our school board on this. And I think this is definitely a step backwards. Right now, we are seeing that the actual teachers are in this and invested in understanding how these vendors are working and how they are using their monies. So I would be very concerned about stepping back and saying that the school board should be the only one that makes the decision, because right now what it's doing is it's bringing all stakeholders in, especially the stakeholder that has the most at stake here. So with that, I would hope that we would move cautiously with this line of language, and specifically would hope that we would take that out. But I want to go back to the revisions and reviews of the social studies standards, and one of the areas that I'm concerned about is that kind of putting the cart before the horse, and specifically pushing this off when we really don't know what's going to happen here. And Representative Erickson, I think what I'd like to hear from you is where they're at right now within those standards. In my conversation with some social studies teachers and some others that are on this committee is that they're actually trying to narrow the scope of many of the standards, saying that they would like to refine it to actually offer some more flexibility within it, to say that it isn't about how many benchmarks are there, but by narrowing that to actually allow teachers of social studies more flexibility in the way that they present in different areas of the social sciences. So would like to hear kind of your take on this, and specifically then, is it just about iPads and textbooks, or is this actually about the implementation of those standards? Because I think that's two different things, and I don't think that we will ever give schools enough for technology and for textbooks and things like that. That I would caution us to say that the reason to delay this is because of the purchase of textbooks, when it should be about the implementation of standards and the ability to implement them with the current textbooks or current technology that is in place.
Thank you, Representative Kath. Representative Erickson, if it's all right with you, Lisa Larson would like to clarify some language on this particular section, if you don't mind, before
Thank you, Madam Chair. You
make a comment. Lisa Larson.
Madam Chair, Representative Greiling, members, the question came up about what the legislature intended with respect to rulemaking under the Section 1 that's being amended in your mandate reduction bill. And I would submit to you that it's not clear at all, because if you look at Subdivision 1 of that same section, it's not in this bill, but if you look in the law, 120B.023 Subdivision 1 as opposed to Subdivision 2, I think there are three paragraphs that are in conflict with one another. For example, in Subdivision 1, Paragraph C, there is language that says that the commissioner may change the benchmarks only with specific legislative authorization. And yet in paragraph E, it says the benchmarks are not subject to Chapter 14. And in addition, in paragraph D, there's a direction to the commissioner to develop and implement a system for reviewing each of the required standards and related benchmarks. Well, the language in Subdivision 2 requires alignment. Did the legislature intend rulemaking or not? I submit to you that it's impossible to discern the answer to that question simply by reading the law.
Thank you, Ms. Larson. Representative Erickson.
Well, Representative Depke, Representative Greiling, and others who are here, Representative Mariani, we know that this was really kind of the Midnight Express, and I don't think we knew what we were doing either. So thank you, Ms. Larson, for that clarification. I think this is probably an issue we need to clarify, and that, I think, can be done as we move to K-12 finance. Representative Greiling, Representative Mariani serve on that committee along with me, so I hope that we can maybe straighten that out, because Ms. Larson has exposed just how convoluted sometimes our language can be as we decide whether or not we're going to have the involvement of an agency or even in regard to the benchmarks of the standards. To answer Representative Kath's question, as I've said, all of these requests came from school boards and from superintendents, and they are concerned about the finances. I have no idea what's going to happen in regard to education funding. I serve on the finance committee, but I do not know what direction the chair might take us. I think we have to realize the economy is not going to turn around for a while, so funding will be tight in whatever direction it goes. Secondly, what Beth Ani and her committee are working on is to make sure that the standards are grade level standards, benchmarks, I should say, that they're grade level now instead of being the strands. And I think you heard her refer to that last Thursday. That was the greatest criticism of the social studies standards as they were reviewed by national groups, is that they were strands instead of grade specific. And I do believe that this committee is working to narrow the focus as well. And I look forward to their public meetings now that will occur. As Ms. Ani said, they are setting the schedule. We should pay attention to the schedule, make sure that our constituency are attending these regional meetings so they can weigh in with the parameters of the revised social studies standards. And remember, that'll be in American history, U.S. history, geography, civics and government, and economics. And I do look forward to seeing the drafts that will be presented to the public.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. Would you like to proceed with questions, or would you like to go into
Why don't we have some testifiers, Madam Chair, okay, in regard to all the sections? They all seem to be controversial, so let's just hear from anyone who wants to bring forth a concern.
Okay, very good. I think our first testifier is Mr. Bob Meyer. If he's in the audience, would you please come forward? Mr. Meyer, please state your name clearly and the organization that you're representing today. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Meyer. I'm the Director of Community Education for the Chisago Lake School System, and I'm here today representing the Minnesota Community Education Association. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify today. On behalf of the Minnesota Community Education Association, its 1,400 members, we are opposed to the proposed change in section House File 511, Section 4. It would be line 4.26 in your document. This proposal would raise the minimum district population from the current 2,000 to 10,000. A licensed, competent director trained in the principles and practices of community education brings a unique and practical knowledge of the best practices in community involvement and engagement. Sophisticated financing that leverages $6 for every dollar of state aid and local levy, legal and personnel issues, and program scope that meet the needs of each community. These issues, among others, are why it's critically important to have a licensed director administering the program of this nature. What would be the impact of this change? Currently, there are 49 districts that have a population of 2,000 or less. Raising the ceiling to 10,000 would allow 236 districts out of 340 to operate a community education program without a licensed, trained community education professional. I submit to you that the result would be a dramatic drop in programming for youth and adults statewide. With a licensed director, we are seeing huge return on investments. Community education directors are required by state law to monitor and maintain the community education funds. These funds include early childhood family education, school readiness, adult basic education, and of course the general community ed fund. Directors are specially trained for this kind of financial oversight. Statewide, community education and its licensed professionals manage $39 million in local levy and aid. This is entrusted to us by our taxpayers. We leverage this amount to provide well over $264 million in needed services, from preschool to senior citizens. This is a 675% return on investment, an investment that provides 900,000 adults, 1.7 million youth, and nearly 285,000 preschool children's services in various community education programs annually. We have wondered why the change. We're assuming that the reason for this requested change in state law is because the pool of potential candidates is perceived to be low, or that the districts are having difficulty finding qualified candidates. However, we would submit, and we've heard today, that this change in law is unnecessary. A provision in law already exists for school districts to request a waiver from the Board of School Administrators if a district cannot find a qualified candidate. A review of the data reveals that since 2008, only 10 school districts have requested a waiver or a letter of approval for community education directors. Out of the 10, 9 were approved, 1 was denied. In the same period, there were requests for 14 principal variances, 11 superintendent, and 18 special ed directors. These are small numbers compared to the number of administrators that there are in Minnesota. Currently, there are only 4 school districts that have a waiver or a variance for community education director. One can only assume that there are 336 districts who meet the current statute. Based on this information, there appears to be no reason to make the change. I want to thank you for your time, and if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Meyer. Are there any questions for the testifier? Yes, Representative Driscoll.
Sir, thank you for sharing and shedding some light on the topic. I've always had a kind of a philosophical grapple with two items that are within the school system. One is athletic directors, and the second is community education directors. And currently, there is no licensing requirement for athletic directors, and many of the things that you articulated very well, I think, apply to athletic directors as well. As I've been involved in community education in my community and been on the advisory council for some 6-plus years, and actually have done fundraising for the group and really have been an active participant in it, I understand the need for licensure when it comes to the early family childhood development portion, but my question becomes, with community education, with the classes that are offered and different kinds of things, could there be some flexibility in your mind on how those are offered through activities directors? Because a lot of districts have gone from athletic directors to activity directors and may want to broaden that out, or that the school district could look at having a person that they would dedicate to that type of activity, and maybe some of those other education items be retained by the superintendent of schools. just curious your thoughts on that, because like I say, I've grappled with it, and I just like to hear some other thoughts.
Well, I think the community education program is very complex at very all levels. I mean, we work with the early childhood, as you referenced, all the way up to senior citizens. We have the adult basic education component, and of course the after-school activities for youth. There are many, many different levels that I'm not, I believe that the training that is required by license now prepares a person for that type of job. We're also seeing many districts somewhat in the reverse, where budgets tighten that their middle school sports are actually being put down towards onto community education, not into the high school level. And I think it has to do with the trained personnel that are in those positions.
Thank you, Mr. Meyer, and Representative Driscoll.
To that point of taking advantage of that, I think that schools utilizing resources to the best of their abilities. I guess some of the districts that I'm familiar with, you have business managers who can take care of the financing, not only for this specialized area, but for other areas. And the area that I wouldn't want to see compromised would be the early childhood portion, and I would assume that the superintendent of schools would be able to have that job and or retain that authority as the superintendent of schools if something happening within the district. Again, I could be wrong. We may have to have someone specialized in an area that the superintendent wouldn't have experience or background in. And if that's the case, you may want to look at that as a structural issue, but that's maybe a topic for another day. To broaden those kinds of activities, I know that in the district that I'm involved with, a lot of those are integrated in with other service providers to organize the services and to organize the delivery, other than necessarily just sponsoring and the recruitment and delivery of those types of programs. And I say I've given this a lot of thought over the last number of years, and so I do have some, I'll say, solid ideas on how this should proceed. I don't know if you want to react to some of those thoughts or comments.
Well, I think the
Mr. Meyer.
Madam Chair, thank you. The whole idea of other service providers, again, those are integrating the community into the school is still one of the roles that community education provides. And in some communities, that is the best way to provide those services. But again, it's through a licensed trained director that is able to connect those resources in the community and meet the needs of the people in their community. So again, I think it's one of those skills that licensure and the competencies provide for.
Thank you, Mr. Meyer. Are there
Madam
any
Chair,
other?
Oh, I yes. Have a question of Mr. Meyer.
Absolutely.
Since he's sitting right here next to me. Of course, this is permissive language. Remember, this is something districts boards have been able to do with that population of 2,000, but is there a population, just to honor the fact that superintendents and school boards are looking for some mandate relief, is there a population level that would be more applicable, do you think, to our small school districts so that we could raise it from 2,000 but not go as far as 10,000?
I believe there is, Madam Chair.
Yes, Mr. Meyer.
I believe there is room for a conversation. I couldn't today tell you where that would be because of the number of districts that are affected by that change. There's like 90 school districts between 2,000 and
right.
5,000
right.
That we'd have to look at, consider what is the impact on those districts.
Thank you, Mr. Meyer, and thank you, Madam Chair, because I think we can work on this. Get the school boards association to weigh in, superintendents, community of directors. I think we could reach a number that might be more amenable to the smaller school districts, who seem to be the districts who are asking us for relief. And maybe 10,000 was going just a little high, and we can pull that back. So thanks, Mr. Meyer.
Thank you,
thank you, Representative Erickson. Very good. We do have another testifier that would like to come up, and that is Dan Campo from the Minnesota School Counselors Association. Yes. Members, just so that you know, we are going to take the testifiers, and then please feel free after that. I have several members on the list that are waiting to ask questions as well. So we will do that after we hear our testifiers.
Good morning, members. My name is Dan Campo. I represent the Minnesota School Counseling Association. We did have another testifier, Chris Moe, who was the president of the Minnesota School Counselors. He was supposed to be here today, but he had to be in his school to take care of students there. So I'm just going to sort of sum up a little bit of history for the members. Basically, the Safe Schools Levy was enacted after Columbine as an effort to try and increase safety within schools, covering a broad scope of things. Basically, in the last 20 years, when we started talking about it, I'm going to jump ahead a little bit here, but in the last 20 years, we've talked about student-to-counselor ratios. Now, nationally, we are 48th to 49th out of 50 states. We're basically dead last. We have been for 20 years, and that has been a choice within the districts on hiring. When they're hiring people, we have heard the argument, and I've heard it in committee, you know, we want to be able to hire English teachers, math teachers, things like that. On behalf of the school counselors, we get that. That's very, very important. We also understand that the maintenance of effort piece only went into effect last year. So what we're dealing with is that over the last 20 years of choice, with districts being able to hire whomever they wanted, that they chose not to hire the counselors. Now, when you take a look at that ratio of 48th to 49th in the nation consistently over a 20-year period, what we're looking at is that now, with the economy changing and things like that, suicides are increasing, that funding streams, even though we do have to see budget cuts, and I get that, it doesn't help for the students. At the end of the day, the students are still dealing with the same issues, and those stresses are increasing. So what we're looking at is that if we have an increasing student risk, that we have increasing suicides within the districts, and we have a piece of legislation that is the maintenance of effort that has only been enacted for 1 year, we strongly oppose the removal of that maintenance of effort because we don't feel that it has been given appropriate amount of time. But if that is what this committee chooses to do, is to remove the maintenance of effort piece, we'd like to just throw out there there has to be another solution. Is there an alternative that can provide ratios of students to counselors that makes it acceptable? If you look at the five-state area with the Dakotas, Iowa, Wisconsin, they're sitting in an average ratio of 420 students to one school counselor. We are at, I believe, 770 students to one counselor right now. So that's it in summary. If anyone has any questions, I'm happy to stick around.
Are there any questions for Mr. Campo? I believe Representative Benson has one.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's not actually a question, but a little discussion of this issue. As Representative Depke probably remembers, and Representative Loon, if she were here, and a number of others, I worked on a working group on mandate reduction. And we actually got it in the omnibus bill, but it died, you know, on the House floor. And this issue of maintenance of effort was very problematic for me because it is a mandate, and I'm trying to get rid of mandates. So I found myself in a difficult situation. But looking at the fact that Minnesota is so abysmal in its student counselor ratio, I thought something ought to be done. But the maintenance of effort legislation that has been on the books, in my opinion, hasn't worked very well. There weren't sufficient funds. We had difficulty with seniority questions with the union, problems that the districts had if they were to maintain the student counselor ratios as funding and enrollments dropped, all those kinds of problems. On the 17th, I left with Ms. Larson a draft of an amendment to try to deal with this question, and she, as she always does, quickly responded to me on the very same day, and for some reason, neither my office nor I caught that communication. So I'm sitting here with an amendment which I had hoped I could have presented But I believe that if one misses a deadline, one has to suffer the consequences. So I'm hoping that maybe one of my colleagues, when we get to a K-12 finance, can bring this amendment forward. But I just wanted to discuss it briefly with the indulgence of the committee and the chair, if I may, just for a moment or two. And the proposal is basically to direct the Commissioner of Education to submit to the legislature by January 1st, 2012, a proposal to find a way to provide all our public school students with access to licensed counselors, consistent with Clause 6, so the counselor-student ratio in Minnesota public schools can approximate or equal the combined average of counselor-student ratios in the public schools in North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, and Wisconsin, because as determined by the American School Counselors Association. So it is a mandate to the commissioner, and we hire these bright people and pay them good salaries, so I'm figuring if we give them a year to work on this, they maybe are able to come up with a solution to this Gordian knot we have to really deal with a problem that Minnesota uniquely is facing. Having spent my career in the classroom, I know the value of counseling services, and I know that nearly one-third of all schools in the state of Minnesota now have no counseling services whatever. And this is a serious problem that we ought to face, and this reform committee would have been the proper place for me to submit this amendment, unless there is an indulgence from the floor, from the chair. But otherwise, I will ask a compatriot to bring this forward in K-12 finance.
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Benson. I'm going to let other people ask questions and testify to this point, and then I do have some, as the author of this particular bill, I do have some comments on it. So I'll go next to Representative...
Madam Chair.
Oh, Representative Erickson.
I just wanted to respond to Representative Benson because, you know, I also understand the need for counselors. What I observed in my years was that we vacillated between counselors and deans and some other model. And what I learned to understand from within our high school, for example, was that administrations wanted so much to have flexibility, so that if they wanted to try the dean model and the dean then became the counselor, and I believe we had three of those, that worked really well. And I believe my school still, my former high school where I taught, still uses that model. So, you know, if we're going to have a mandate such as the one that Representative Depke is trying to repeal, I do think that we honor that ability for school districts to have different models. And certainly we want our students to have availability to counselors for a variety of reasons. But I certainly think that it's going to be just fine if you bring up that debate or have someone bring that up in K-12. Sorry, Representative Depke, I just wanted to relate to Representative Benson my experience.
That's quite all right. Thank you, Representative Erickson. And Representative Benson, you have a follow-up?
Well, I agree. The district I taught in did have both, actually. They had a counseling service, and some of these activities were carried on by the dean of students, and that seemed to work well, too. But the point was, in my district, that was a different time and a different century. And at that time, the resources were still there. So when we're in a situation as we are now, the tendency is to cut, and sometimes these types of services for students pay the price, as they have here in Minnesota. And so this amendment, which I had hoped to present, simply was asking the commissioner to come up with a strategy to see if there is not a way or strategies to deal with this, I think, problem that all of us acknowledge. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Benson. I believe Representative Norton would like. Representative Norton is a co-author with me on this particular piece of legislation, so I would like her to be next, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I certainly think Representative Benson brings up something that might be a nice compromise. I think we need to move forward with this repeal because of the protected class issue and some of the other issues that came up in the longer testimony with Representative Depke. But I think this is a really nice piece maybe we could put in place instead, and I really appreciate it. I think you're working in the right path there. There are a couple of things I want to raise, a couple issues. The impact of charter schools in Minnesota and how that has impacted our student council ratio might be worth considering. We have a large number of charter schools. Charter schools are exempted from some of the rules that other districts have. They tend to be very small. Many of them don't have counselors. They handle their students in a small, more personal manner, many of them. I think that is influencing the ratio in our state, as is the use of counselors and nurses and many other deans and many other professionals. So I think part of that study needs to really look at the different types of schools we have in the state of Minnesota compared to some of the other states around us. Because we were a leader in charters, we have more of them as a percent of our districts. So I think that's a good discussion for us to have, as well as the difference between the use of counselors in high school, where you're looking at placement into college and taking the proper courses, and how that differs with counselors in middle and secondary or elementary schools, which tends to be more on a personal level. And I just think there's a really great discussion that we need to have about the use of counselors as a whole. And so I would very much encourage us to move forward with some form of Representative Benson's amendment. I do want to clarify, however, something that was said last year. I carried this particular piece of legislation, and I amended it on Representative Benson's mandate reduction bill, because we've been working on mandate reductions for quite some time. It received strong bipartisan support in the it wasn't the Reform Committee at that time, but it was the Policy Committee, and went on that bill bipartisanly with a very strong vote and was moved forward. And I just want to be very clear, it was taken out in the next committee on a delete all, which is very, very unusual. It was said this is just a delete all to put the bill in the form that the author wants it, and many very serious provisions, including the school start time and that maintenance of effort were in that. People didn't even know what they voted on, so it was removed. So it did not go to the floor in the omnibus bill or in the mandate reduction bill. We did try a floor amendment. Representative Depke moved it, and it didn't get on. So there has been some discussion, but I really think this is a serious issue that has serious repercussions for our buildings and our students, and I think Representative Benson's suggestion is a good one, and I hope you seriously take that into consideration, and maybe we can modify this bill as it moves along and have that component in it. So I just wanted to add that this isn't about hurting students, this maintenance of effort. It really is a completely different issue. I think we've perhaps as a legislature handled this poorly in the past and have gotten ourselves in an awkward position, and we're trying to find our way out and help our schools, and I think we can do that. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Norton. Representative Mariani, to this point, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be very brief. And of course, we tend to want to respect the author of the bill's wishes in terms of how we move forward, and certainly the chair has rules about amendments. But I just want to, just a very quick caution, if there is a will on the policy committee to forward language similar to Representative Benson's language, and I wouldn't allow, that's too strong a word, I would advise that this committee not get stuck with rules. I mean, if there is a bipartisan will to deal with a very sticky issue, this issue, I'm torn myself about this issue. I don't think the current MOE has worked the way we want it to work. On the other hand, I don't want to back off of it because I'm looking for something else, and it seems to me that many of us feel that way on this issue on both sides of the aisle. And so my only brief advice would be that if there is a will, I would, again, under sort of the sense that policy committees should never yield their authority to establish policy to finance committees, then I would urge us to consider, and I would certainly urge the chair to consider pushing something that begins to offer some kind of middle point on how to deal with a difficult issue, as opposed to allowing finance committees, whose only concern really is only with finance issues, to be able to deal with difficult policy issues.
Thank you, Representative Mariani. But I do have other testifiers. Are any Any questions to that point? Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for your indulgence. This particular amendment, I could draft it as a separate bill and present it to the committee as well, and that might solve our problem for today.
Thank you, Representative Benson. I do have other people that would like have some questions, and thank you very much, Mr. Campo. Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mine is back to when Ms. Larson was addressing her comments to Representative Erickson and me, but I guess you didn't see fit to call on me when it made sense, and now I'm trying to remember what I was going to say. Let me think. Okay. I'm just going to think for a minute. It's come to me. Okay. So much easier to have called on me when the time was ripe, Madam Chair.
Yes, I understand. Apologize for that.
Yes. Ms. Larson was pointing out that we have conflicts in the statute, and Representative Erickson was pointing out that we need to get those solved, and it sounds like we agreed on how to solve them. So I just was going to say, yes, we should do that. And then the other thing I was going to say is, though, that thankfully Ms. Ani informed us that the social studies standards are taking the correct route, and they have been going through administrative rulemaking using Chapter 14. So even though the statute is a mess, they have figured it out, are doing it right, and we shouldn't let that be the reason for us to delay the social studies standard. I hope we can make sure we finance things so that that isn't the reason either. And it seems to me finances are the reason we're in this muddle with the school counselors bill, because Representative Erickson and Representative Benson were mentioning teaching in the last century when it was made more sense to have counselors and or deans because we had the money for both. And now the fact that we're in this situation with counselors, and it's also this, we should remember this is not just counselors, this maintenance of effort applies to all school support staff, school nurses and others, social workers and psychologists and chemical dependency staff. And when you don't have enough money, then you do get into these Gordian knots or Sophie's choices, and that's our problem here, I believe, is the fact that we have underfunded our schools actually since 1984 if we factor in the CPI and hold out special ed and building expenses that aren't classroom-oriented for the kids who aren't special ed and so forth. So when we ask if we do a bill or an amendment, and I would support Representative Mariani's advice to do this amendment now and strike while the iron is hot, Representative Benson, instead of a bill that may or may not go anywhere on its own, then I think that the commissioner will be hard-pressed to come up with anything minus money, because that's the problem here.
Thank you, Representative Greiling.
Madam Chair, yes. I think we need to remember that this is mandate relief. We received from school boards about 100 items that they feel we have mandated on them over the years. And I just hope we can provide some relief and trust in our school boards that they can make decisions about flexibility, about how to spend the dollars to the best of our children's education and their future. So I'd like us to focus on the mandate relief, Madam Chair. And perhaps since Greg Crow has had to sit here so long, if anyone has a question about the fund transfer in Section 8, I know he has lots of work to do, and he has been so patient sitting here now for over an hour. If there are any questions on Section 8, maybe he could address those, and we could let him get back to work in his office.
Is there anyone that would like to ask a question on Section 8 of the bill?
I think, Mr. Crow, you can leave. Thank you very much for being here. And I'm sorry, I should have called attention to your sitting there long ago, because I know you have so much work to do.
Representative Dabney, I believe you have the next question.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And my question relates to Section 1, Subdivision 2 of the bill, specifically to you, Representative Erickson, could you explain, particularly lines 1.18 and 1.19, what are you requiring the commissioner to do, and what authority do you provide the legislature, particularly on those lines?
Madam Chair and Representative Dabney, my intent is that once the public has weighed in from these public hearings, the draft is presented and we've gone to rulemaking, that the standards, the benchmarks, the graduation requirements, all of that will come back to us to review. Not necessarily to change, but to review.
Madam Chair, Representative
Erickson, Commissioner will have the changes before us. So,
yeah, Representative Dabney,
I'm still not understanding the authority you're granting the legislature in this language. Is this a report that the commissioner submits to us, or are we, as we did in, was it 2003?
Three and four.
Do we work over the standards and change the standards, benchmarks, and all the like, and change them as the legislature sees fit?
Madam Chair and Representative Dabney, no, I don't think we should be changing them. I think they should be submitted to us for review after the commissioner has made the changes that were brought forward by the public and by the 50 members who are serving on the committee. And I don't anticipate that we're going to write standards. I think that's not our job.
So, Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, the intent of this legislation is that the commissioner report to us, but does not grant the legislature any authority to change the work of the committee, the department, and the rulemaking process. Is that correct?
Correct.
Thank you.
Representative Norton, you have a follow-up question from a previous one.
I'm not sure if you've got a list of people to testify yet. I just had a comment or question about Section 7 and 9, so I can wait my turn.
That would be wonderful. Thank you very much. The next question is Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my question is about the Safe Schools Levy. I don't know if we're able to ask questions about that particular section.
Yes, you are.
Sure. The question I think is for might be for Mr. Campo. It's related to the opinion from the St. Paul Pioneer Press, I guess. I'm not sure who presented.
Thank you, Mr. Campo. We'll be coming back to the testifying chair. Representative Barrett, your question to Mr. Campo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Campo, reading the article here, it's very interesting and certainly very accurate as it relates to the importance of school counselors related to many areas, post-secondary education, crisis management, and then working with students in a one-on-one basis regarding their life issues that may affect their schoolwork. It doesn't talk about prevention, though. And so I'm wondering if you could address the issue of prevention and how school counselors work to prevent violence prevention, drug and alcohol prevention in their schools in more of a less than targeted way, so that all schools, all students in the district could get the advantage of understanding prevention techniques and methods.
Mr. Campo.
Madam Chair, members. Being a lobbyist, not a school counselor, getting into the details of that's going to be a little bit difficult for me. What I can tell you on the prevention aspect and what has been passed on to me is that prevention is actually the biggest key in what counselors are trying to do. Prevention starts with the meeting of every student and assessing a student, and many times that can be just a simple thing like discussing where their classes are, what courses they want to take. Because school counselors in the state of Minnesota have a master's degree, they spend an extra 2 years dealing with psychological issues, things like that, and are more able to identify possibilities of students having issues before they surface. So yes, there are, and many times a student will come into a school counselor's office and say, hey, I have a problem. But they usually, what is also happening is that the counselor is required, because they're spending time with every student, to actually meet with them and assess how that student is doing. Many times, as we all know, especially, you know, I mean, anything from grade school to high school, kids are apprehensive about telling an adult, an educator, about their problems. So when we talk about prevention, we talk about identifying things. There are also testing that is done in the schools and other assessments that counselors do that they use in as a method of screening for that. Is that...
Thank you, Mr. Campo. A follow-up question, if I could, Madam.
Yes, a follow-up question for Representative Barrett.
And I think it's more of a comment than a question, but if you have some comments about that, I'd appreciate your thoughts, Mr. Campo. As it relates to this section and the relief of the mandate related to safe schools, certainly a part of safe schools, as we talked about, is drug abuse prevention, violence prevention. There are many evidence-based curricula on the market that relate specifically to violence prevention and alcohol and drug prevention that some school districts use, other school districts don't. They're pretty economical. And so I look at this section as an impediment to using money in the most cost-effective manner for the best possible result. And so I'm not saying that these programs might replace a school counselor, but they certainly would be a cost-effective measure to get at a wide-ranging prevention program in which all students in the school could utilize, as opposed to the direct services that a counselor might provide one-on-one or in certain situations more of a crisis management perspective. So I'd like to caution our committee here that there are other alternatives rather than just a counselor for a particular drug and alcohol prevention or violence prevention situation or prevention method in a particular school. Thank you.
Mr. Campo.
Madam Chair, members. You know, you bring up a very good point. There are different types of software. There are different critiques and things like that, testing, things like that, that have been on the market for some time. What those, all of those programs do is provide an insight into a student, and they help, as I mentioned earlier. Those are tools that counselors are using across the state every day. But again, you have somebody who is a mental health professional. In addition to doing things like helping students with classes and things like that, but they are actually a mental health professional who is then able to analyze the results from those type of tests, from those type of softwares and things like that, and more adequately get children help. So in essence, I agree with you that there are programs out there. They can be beneficial. Those are tools in the toolbox that a school counselor would use. So if you think of it from that sense, you still need the mechanic there to pick the tools out of the toolbox and apply them to the appropriate student and make sure that those things happen. We talk about prevention. Testimony in other committees has been, and it's difficult to go into that, but when we talk, I mentioned Columbine. Look, prevention is key. We're talking about suicides today. We're talking, you know, we can talk graduation rates. We can talk about other things. There are also the extreme cases on the other side of things like Red Lake, of Columbine, of things like that. When we talk about prevention, it's getting to students before there is a problem, before a student attempts the suicide, or in the case of a Columbine or something like that. Look, by the time a student brings a gun to school and it's caught on a video camera, and the news is reporting on it, we've already lost. It, at that point, we're in a triage situation. So the prevention aspect is key, and you know those situations are rare. What we're really talking about is how to take young people who are growing up and make them productive members of society to work through their issues, to work through those things. And that's what those tools that you mentioned really help doing. But it does take a person with that training and that ability to analyze them.
Madam Chair, if I may.
Yes, Representative Barrett. We do have 25 minutes left, and we have seven people to testify.
I'll make it brief. Mr. Campo, thank you. I think we agree for most part on everything you just said. I'm looking at what is the best use of resources to accomplish the prevention goals that we all care about for our kids. Thank you.
Thank you. We do have six more testifiers. Yep. Representative Erickson. Okay. Next is Representative Peterson, Sandra.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's been an interesting discussion, and I certainly agree with most of the discussion that it is it's a very complex issue. We and to the last question by the representative, I know personally that many of the elementary schools do use those kinds of curriculum and books, and they're very effective. I think when you get to the high school, it's a different situation. I have served on a crisis team at a high school, and it does take a one-to-one situation with each child and a team effort, actually. But I want to go to moving away from that piece of an important piece of what counselors do to the idea that because our schools don't have money, and I've seen it happen. In the high school I was in, we cut counselors so that we could have science classes where the students could have a place to sit. I mean, when we get into situations where the schools don't have enough money, we start cutting some important services, and that's why the maintenance of effort seems to be important in keeping students, but it also has some unintended consequences, and so we're trying to deal with this complex issue. My concern is that the counselors should be playing an important role in helping with the achievement gap, and that means that they ought to be helping with the career planning starting in the junior high school. And actually, the Governor's Workforce Development Council has a new book. If you haven't seen it, it's very good, and talks about what we need to do in the high schools and the junior highs to develop readiness for the workforce. And one of those is a career plan that starts in the junior high and continues all the way through the high school. Now, that's a portfolio that many, many families that I know are actually starting in the elementary schools. They're starting to get their students to think about what they're doing, how it impacts their lives, and then eventually, how do they put together a career plan or start talking about careers? Because if they wait till the high school, till junior or senior, to decide what they're going to do, they very often have not taken the right kinds of courses, not had the right kinds of interventions that might help them to be ready for college or higher education or the workforce. So, you know, we need to start having counselors work early with our students and to continue that kind of intervention all the way through so that when these students leave our high schools, they are ready for whatever comes next. And I think if you don't have that, students, parents very often aren't involved in the class decisions with their high school students. It seems to me that mostly the counselors. And when we have a shortage, that kind of service gets neglected. In addition, in my district, we have a high school where we have such high mobility and the needs of the students. It takes a full-time counselor just to do the administrative work. And I say administrative, it really is the counseling that goes with the students who are transferring from one school to another to deal with the special education needs, to deal with the kinds of interventions that are needed as those students go from one school to another. I actually have a bill on that too, but again, because of the cost, I'm sure it won't get heard. But the career planning is important.
Representative Peterson, I'm sorry to interrupt you. We do need to... we have several other people to testify,
okay.
And I appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
A lot of very good ideas, and so we will.
Okay.
I think.
Thank you. It was just a little plea for more counselors.
No, I understand.
And understanding the not knowing where I would be with the memorandum of understanding because it is maintenance of effort, not knowing where we are with that because it's a really complex issue.
Yes.
Thank you
very much. The next would be Representative Norton, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There were two questions I had on different sections of the bill, so I'm going to skip to Section 7 on the staff development. I just want to let you know, there are portions of this, your kind of omnibus mandate reduction bill that I like. There are other portions I don't like. This particular one I had a question about. I appreciated that it was only 2 years. I know districts are asking for this, particularly school boards and superintendents. And you have the comment may use the revenue, so I'm assuming this means that the mandate reduction is that you don't have to ask the unions, which is currently able to be done. And in fact, I know in my district, as a board member, we actually, our teachers did allow the district to use money in a time of crisis, and I believe that's up for discussion again. So my question is, do we know how many districts have already done this across the state who have taken advantage of the current language, which allows teachers to help solve the issues of revenue and with a voluntary reduction? Do we have any?
Representative Norton, I don't have that number, but perhaps someone in the audience does.
Is there someone in the audience that has knowledge on the 2% set aside, the teachers?
And if they don't, that we'll see what they have to say. And I'll follow up.
Yep, Mr. Schneiderwin looks like he's coming to the testifying table. Mr. Schneiderwin, please say your name clearly and the organization you represent.
Yes. My name is Kirk Schneiderwin with the Minnesota School Boards Association, and I believe that the staff development set aside was waived for the last current year, so I don't know if the requirement would still be implied. My guess is the requirement to vote would not apply, so districts can waive the that piece. So.
Thank you, Mr. Schneider.
I don't know how many districts have that. Was
the I'm sorry. Can you?
Well, I'm just curious as to how many districts have either under the past law where they could vote to do it, how many have done it, and how many currently, if we have the waiver in place already, how many are taking advantage of that?
Madam Chair and Representative Norton, I'm not sure. I don't have that data, but we can certainly explore and talk to the department, see what they have, maybe perhaps, because they're the ones that collect the staff development report, and they may have an idea of how many have.
Okay, I would just be curious, and Madam Chair and Representative Erickson, I think my concern with this is, you know, we do have to do something, and as I said, I appreciate the limited time on this, but one of the things that I heard about my first month and a half while we sat in this committee and also in higher ed is that teacher quality is important, and that one of the ways we do that is through staff development, and yet what is the one thing we keep taking away from schools and teachers? It's staff development. So I think it's counterintuitive to what we talk about all the time in here, which is making sure teachers are high quality and have opportunities to develop. So I guess enough said on that. And then could I ask, just mention something on
Madam
Section
Chair,
9?
Could I address that?
Yes, Representative Erickson.
Representative, I appreciate your comments. I don't think the intent is to take away any staff development. In fact, in the teacher evaluation draft that I'm continuing to revise, there is need for staff development. So districts will have the flexibility to use that, but there's certainly going to be staff development in a teacher evaluation. So I think you can be assured that it's not going to go away.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, just Section 9, I'm just going to put out there, we had quite a discussion about this. That's the January 15th repealer. And we had a Representative Downey and maybe Representative Barrett, I don't remember who the other one was that brought those bills forward. I have indeed filed two other options. Representative Downey has signed on to both. So as you move forward, I would just ask that you consider several other options rather than just a complete repealer of the January 15th, because I think there are ways we could do what you want to do, but perhaps do it better for all involved. So just throwing that out there.
Thank you, Representative Norton and Madam Chair. I think we have the January 15th repeal wandering around in many places, in bills and in introductions, and that's true of staff development and the maintenance of effort. They're just found everywhere, I've noticed. So I think we'll be addressing something, Representative Norton.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. We do have four more questions. Five more questions. Representative Keel.
She's looking the other way. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'm sorry, Representative Keel.
I apologize. I stepped out for a little bit. But I wanted to, when we were discussing the maintenance of effort, I wanted to share how nice it is when we can have flexibility. Our school district had a dean for 2 years and had to cut it back, only has one counselor for 15 or about 1,300 students. When I was on the board, there's a school psychologist in the building, but I know she's overworked. And as we worked with different people in our community, we're recognizing that our students were also part of the social services, and so we are blessed with a mental health center in our community, and so what we did was we made an agreement with them, and they came into our building at particular times, and they were working with families both through social services in the school district, and so these children were not being served by three different people, the school, the social services, and maybe sometimes the criminal system. They were served by one person that was coordinating their family situation or whatever it is they needed, and then the school was able to assist when they needed to. These people were, the social workers were actually in our buildings, and it worked. I think it's working very well. It is continuing. It isn't costing the school a great deal of money. And so my point is that flexibility is really the key to let our schools decide what they're doing. I believe this mental health center is actually going to a couple of our smaller schools within our county also. So for whatever it is, that flexibility is really important because we just couldn't finance all of that. So.
Thank you, Representative Keel. We have four more questions left. Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was listening carefully to the author's intent relative to Section 1, Subdivision 2, and while I'm still a little bit nervous about where this could lead us, having watched our cousins in Texas and Arizona melt down before the national eye relative to irreconcilable differences in terms of understanding what standards ought to be doing. I do think that the language that's before us right now does not reflect Representative Erickson's your intent as you responded to Representative Dabney's language. And so I've been working with Representative Dabney very quickly here to try to get language that actually lines this up better. And so, Madam Chair, I'm wondering if I can yield to Representative Dabney to suggest language here that can meet the author's intent.
Representative Erickson, you're the author of the bill.
Yes, Representative Depke and Representatives Dabney and Mariani. We're all in K-12 together. These are all financial issues as well as reform issues. I would recommend that we wait and get a clearer understanding of what this language does mean and how we might change it later. So I prefer that we wait till K-12 to do that. This goes to government operations and then on to K-12. And if there's contradictory language here, if you don't understand that I believe we don't write standards, but we will accept or reject whatever the commissioner brings before us, then it goes back to the committee, as I understand it.
Well,
Representative Mariani.
Madam Chair and yes. Representative Erickson, the place to debate whether I understand it or not is right here in this committee. And but I certainly would abide by your desires to let your bill go forward with a huge question mark relative to the intent that you expressed here verbally to the committee. My intent, quite honestly, was only to offer language that I think reflects what you said your intent is. However, if the chair wishes to, and the author wishes to move forward, that's fine with me.
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative Mariani, as a chair, you know that we can do that. So I would prefer we move forward, Madam Chair.
All right, we will move forward then.
Yes.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Because of time, I think I'll pass, but I just want to support Representative Peterson's comments on maintenance of effort. It was basically my view as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Benson. Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This has been a very, very interesting conversation, and I have truly heard a lot and learned a lot by being here. And I don't have a question, but I just have a short comment around some of the conversation. Because what I have heard is that we all, and my point is to Section 6, Safe School Levies, and the importance of the maintenance of effort. And what I've heard around the table is that we can all agree on the importance of having counselors and other professional staff on hand within schools. And we know that here in the 21st century, the complications and the issues that come with our young kids are huge. And so it is just my belief that when we remove a mandate that in some way helps some school to ensure that there are counselors in place in schools where they need to be, we also create unintended consequences that may happen. And so I really feel torn by unintended consequences when we don't come up with a solution as to how we can support and have services in place in our school system for our kids who are carrying the burdens of many, many issues and problems that we have all addressed around this table. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Moran. And Representative Dabney, I believe you're the last person to ask, our representative to ask a question.
I can pass. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Representative Erickson, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To my bill, or the bill 511 as amended, the intent here is to bring some relief to those mandates that we have legislated over the years. Except for the freshmen sitting at this table, we are all responsible for having mandated. We're responsible for language, and there's always room for improvement. If language in this mandate relief bill needs clarification, I'm the first one to say, yes, it does, because we don't want to continue to contradict ourselves. So that's basically my statement in regard to Section 1. We certainly want to consider how the changes in a community education director might affect districts larger than perhaps 5,000, but those are conversations that the interested parties need to have with me and committee members before this moves on to K-12 finance. So I welcome suggestions. I've not had anyone stop by my office to express concerns. I think we all understand that we have far too many mandates on our school boards, and we need to let them run the show, so to speak. If we elect them to be the employers, then let's let them be that, and let's hope that we can work out language that is not going to be in conflict and language that's going to free them up a bit. And I don't want to think of these mandates in regard to the tough economic situation we're in, even though I know that is maybe one of the reasons that superintendents and school boards have brought forth this relief, but because over the years we have tried to strangle our school boards, and I think it's time to let them have the freedom that they're in law to do, and that's to run our school districts as the communities expect them to, and as teachers and other school employees weigh in on the decision-making body. So with that, Madam Chair, I'd like to renew my motion that House File 511 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Government Operations.
Representative Erickson renews her motion that House File 511 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Government Operations. Yes.
I'm going to express a little frustration, not with just this bill, but it seems to me that this committee is not doing the work in total. And this bill is a good example of it, where suggestion was just made and other issues by the author's own admission need to yet be resolved. And this is the policy committee or the reform committee, and a bill really shouldn't move on until it's ready to move on. And I think the chair of this committee is delegating a lot of her authority, quite frankly, to other committees. And I would caution members on that. I'm going to vote no, because I don't think this bill is ready to move on to another committee at this point in time. It needs further work, even by the author's own admission.
Thank you, Representative Carlson. We will now take a vote on the bill. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign.
No.
The bill passes, and it will move on to the government operations. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
With that, this meeting is adjourned.